Joining us in the studio is someone that you have no doubt heard on the show that just ended performance today. And I think he's been featured quite a few times on there. Also, well, I can say the same thing about you, Michael. Michael Butterman's in the studio with me, and so frequently we hear you with one of your other orchestras, not necessarily Shreveport, but we're going to talk about the Shreveport Symphony performance tomorrow, in fact, with John Nakamatsu, our other guest, and a very interesting lineup of a concert. So, Michael, I'll let you take it and start talking about it.
Thank you. Well, first of all, good morning. And it is with great anticipation that we are talking about this concert happening tomorrow evening. This is, of course, a year in which we are looking at all things American, in this 250th anniversary year, and that includes this concert, as a matter of fact, which includes this wonderful concerto by Edward McDowell, his piano concerto number 2 that John is going to be playing for us. This is a work, you know, written in the late 19th century that was, for quite a while in the mid part of the 20th century, a real staple of concert programs. Right, yeah. And it was one of Van Cliburn's signature pieces, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. But it's one that just hasn't been performed so much, I would say, in the last 30, 40 years, maybe. No,
I think
something.
It's right. I was trying to think back, and I can't think of a performance of the Shreveport Symphony that featured the McDowell in my time here, which, you know, has been a long time. I hate to say how long, but long enough. So this is a unique opportunity for the region, and it's a great piece.
It is a great piece, and we are just so thrilled to welcome John back to Shreveport. He was here, gosh, I can't remember how long it was.
It was quite a while.
And I remember you played among other things. I think maybe you played Ravel and Rhapsody in Blue. I think it was.
It's something. Very possible.
Yes,
it is possible.
At any rate, just wonderful to work with John every single time, and we're looking forward to this collaboration. I'll talk about these other things. We also have some Beethoven on the program, and another work, by the way, the Franck Symphony in D minor, and that's another piece that was very, very popular for a long time, and it just kind of fell out of the rotation in the last 40 years, for no good reason. Both of these pieces, the McDowell and the Franck, are very winning. They're tuneful. Their audiences love them. And so for that reason, it's kind of an interesting pairing, I think.
Yeah. Well, and that parallel for the two of them, it makes a whole lot of sense. But let's talk a little bit about the McDowell. And John, you and I were talking a little bit before here, and this is a concerto that you have not played until Michael asked you to do it. Which is kind of fascinating to me, because I figured at this point in your career you've played this a dozen times. But now talk about this. So this is a new work to you, but yes, it's a staple. So how do you approach something like that?
Well, that's, you know, kind of a rare thing for us as musicians to have. I mean, we do a lot of new pieces, but they're usually new in the sense of just being written, and we're trying to figure them out. Yeah. This is a piece that is fully romantic and almost in some ways more European in style than it is American, but still very much an American creation. In fact, I think I read somewhere that it may have been the first serious piano concerto that was penned in the United States.
Yeah, I think that's right.
That became a major staple. But to actually play something like that and to have it feel new and unfamiliar is really a unique experience, because again, so much of the works that we've do as new are contemporary, so this is like kind of unearthing some treasure that we have left kind of dormant for a little bit. I had known about it for years just because, you know, there was a Van Cliburn recording that I think everyone had at one time. But I didn't know the piece, and it really wasn't until Michael asked me to do it that I said, this is the best excuse I can think of, because there's nothing like a deadline to actually make you do the work. and it's just been a joy. You know, I started looking at it, you know, very, very gradually from the time he hatched the idea, and it's been so much fun. And I today's the first rehearsal, and I just can't wait to try it. But, like, you know, when you're playing a piece that you've never done before, it's largely untested. So we're all kind of in this great experiment together. And you know, just having spoken with some of the orchestra members yesterday at a separate rehearsal, none of them know it, you know. So I think that's in some ways a really fun place to be, because it happens so infrequently. You know, there's always people here and there that, you know, a percentage of the orchestra may have played it, or they know about it, or they've heard it. In this case, I think most people on the stage will never have heard the piece.
I believe that's true.
I think, and the audience too will come in, I believe, fairly cold. And again, it's the excitement of experiencing all of this together as a whole group that I think is particularly thrilling for me.
You know, you're talking about, you perform a lot of contemporary works where you're, you know, the first person to play it or one of the first mm-hmm. people to play these pieces. But so this is a concerto that's been around for a long time, and there are recordings of it. We talked about a few of them, and of course, Van Cliburn, which mm-hmm. You have a connection with that as well. But so given that there are recordings, do you reference them at all to see what other people, because you don't get that opportunity with a contemporary piece, especially if you're premiering it.
Exactly. I mean, the nice thing about having the recordings is that, you know, obviously you can hear how other people have thought about it. With a new piece, you know, the one advantage is that you can now text the composer and just say, I don't know what this means, please help me. Can't really do that with McDowell, but
you can try.
You can try, but he's probably not going to answer for a while. I always, that's a great question, because now that I do some teaching, I have to also navigate that question with students who, you know, when they first want to learn a work, the very first place they go to is their phone, and they try to find a recording, and which is the worst way to do that. But, that's a different story. But I also say, you know, the best time to listen to recordings is not necessarily when you're first starting to the work, when you're first starting to understand what the piece is. I think at that point, for an advanced student or for a musician, the important thing is that you go through it and then you figure out how to play the music, not just the technical aspect of it, but that you figure out what you really want out of the piece. And then at a certain point when it's really internalized, then you can kind of start listening to what other people are doing. And I think that has a better way of preserving, I guess, the work's integrity for you as an individual, rather than being so kind of bombarded by influences early on. And I know sometimes that's unavoidable. Like, I mean, how can you grow up as a musician and not hear the Tchaikovsky piano concerto, right? So we grow up somehow internalized with this internalized version of how it should go. But with a piece like this, when I started, I was just really reading the score almost. And a lot of times I was trying to do what Michael does probably, which is read the score at the desk, you know, like look at the music and conceptualize. I mean, that's what conductors spend their lives doing. You know, they're not doing what we do. Like we're having to just finger the passages all the time. It's real musical understanding. And so that was my process. And then as I got very comfortable with just my own idea of how I thought it should go, I listened to recordings that made me think maybe I didn't know how it should go. Because there are a lot of good ones. There are a lot of really beautiful recordings of this. I mean, there's Van Cliburn, there's Andre Watts, there's Earl Wilde, there's, mm-hmm. you know, many, many people have recorded this, and suddenly it's forgotten and you just think, I don't really understand that. Except that, you know, there's a lot of music out there and a lot of it's good, so.
Yeah, indeed. And so I guess my question goes to you, Michael, sort of the same thing. So have you done this work before?
No, I haven't.
So it's the same kind of thing, yeah.
It is. And two things about what he just was saying. First of all, I can relate to this question of getting input from an external source once you have delved into a work to a large degree. You know, I'm sure, Kermit, but listeners may not, that the New York Philharmonic Archives are digitized, and among mm-hmm. the many things that you can find are marked scores from lots of conductors, but mm-hmm. Bernstein in particular. And I find it very interesting. John's right. I'm not waving my arms around to practice. I'm sitting at a desk and marking up a score and looking at it, imagining what it would sound, trying to figure out where the problems are and how I would solve them and so on. And I generally do that, 75-80% of the way, and then if there is a version available that, you know, of a marked score from someone like Bernstein, it's very interesting to go and look at it and see if he noticed the same things and marked the same kinds of things that, you know, that I did. Much of the time it's kind of validation. He's like, yes, I see, right? Mm-hmm. We both had the same idea here. Other times it's like, I don't know. Well, I'm not sure that, you know, either I think maybe I saw something he didn't, or he sees things in a way that I hadn't thought of, and maybe I should rethink a little bit. But I think that's an interesting perspective that you had about when to seek a third-party perspective on something like that is new to you. The other thing I want to just say is that there's, when I think about introducing new music to audiences, there's really just two kinds. There is music that is brand new and fresh that no one in the universe has heard before, and then there are pieces like this. Yes, it will be new, but it is not unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, you know this language.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
You haven't heard this particular set, way of putting these notes together, but this is a language you will understand. If you know the Grieg Concerto, if you know Rachmaninoff for that matter, you can hear that kind of lyricism and pianism in this piece very clearly. Mm-hmm. It is not a work that anyone is going to have any trouble approaching. Let's put it that way.
Right.
It will seem like an old friend that you probably know, but you can't quite remember, or something like this.
That makes sense.
I guess if there was such a thing as an old friend like that. Anyway, it's. I think it's a nice opportunity to. We're doing a piece next year here, just to spoil it a little bit. It's the Beethoven Violin Concerto, but in the piano version.
Right.
That's another example of something that will be fresh and new, but yet still very familiar.
In its
way. So anyway, I think this is an exciting piece to be both of us kind of doing for the first time. Tomorrow,
right? Which is a great opportunity for the audience too, because you'll be the first audience to hear, two great artists who are approaching this together I think that's amazing in this language that is so familiar to everybody. And you're talking about old friends, but the rest of the program is also that. These are going to be pieces that should be old friends to a lot of the listeners coming.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. The Franck Symphony D minor, so César Franck, a Belgian/French, I guess, composer, mm-hmm. Who is known for his organ works in particular, but this work, his Symphony in D Minor, is one that was, as I mentioned earlier, a real go-to for orchestras whenever they needed a hit, whenever they needed to fill the hall. If there was a big occasion, they were opening a season, they were inaugurating a new venue, whatever. From about the 1920s through probably the mid 60s. This was the piece, even more than Beethoven 5 or Beethoven 9. This was the piece. The New York Times a few years ago did an article that said, whatever happened to the Franck? And they did like a little survey of orchestras that were touring and coming into New York. And they very often when they were coming to Carnegie Hall, they'd be sure they brought the Franck with them because the audience would turn out for that.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's a piece just it's in three movements, like this concerto, as a matter of fact, and it's very much cyclic, which is to say that there is a kind of thematic transformation approach that the composer uses. So you hear this idea at the beginning, ta-ra-dee, which is transformed, as many composers did many, many times, into things heroic, into things melancholy. And it is a piece that just kind of takes you along on this roller coaster of a journey in a very emotional way that I think many of our audience members will know this piece, but they will probably not have heard it for quite a while.
Long time.
Yeah. It's a work, by the way, that has the opening is a little bit, I often think, is a little bit like the Muss es sein, which is a quote from one of Beethoven's late string quartets. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that this was a conscious tribute on the part of Franck or not, but I can't hear those opening bars, this opening theme, without thinking that somehow. And so that is my perhaps flimsy reason for opening the concert with a short work of Beethoven. I like to at least be able to tell myself that I'm not just, putting things together because they sound, that it looks nice on a piece of paper, but that there's a reason for it. So we're opening with the Overture to the Creatures of Prometheus, which is a ballet that Beethoven wrote, but this has a very, very lovely and kind of energetic, peppy 4-minute, 5-minute overture to start. So that's how we're opening, then the McDowell, and then this Franck. And I don't want to take this interview from you, but Franck is something that we're going to hear also on Sunday at the chamber concert that we're doing at Hurley School of Music at the Anderson Auditorium.
Free concert, yeah.
And so we're playing John and members of our orchestra are playing the Franck Piano Quintet.
Oh, Quintet, okay.
Yes, right. Yes. Which is another great work for sure that doesn't get played probably as often as it ought.
It probably not, you know, way back when the Premier Quartet was pretty active. We did it a number of times.
Did you?
Yeah. That's going back.
Been a
that's
while,
going
yeah.
back a long time, mm-hmm, decades. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So, great. I mean, it's an incredible piece. And like all the Franck chamber music, it's like all the work is in the piano part for the most part. And then we get these nice tunes and all of that.
You get to play lyrical melodies. Yeah.
But two great concerts coming up this weekend.
For sure. Also, you have some Chopin, yes?
Yeah, a lot of notes on that concert.
Oh, yeah.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
But what's Chopin's?
Right. It's the Andante Spianato and Grand Polonaise.
Okay, so, all right.
Yeah,
all
just
right.
those two works.
Yeah, well, that's enough for that program. So that, again, is a free concert. That is Sunday afternoon. And, of course, tomorrow for tickets to hear the McDowell and the César Franck and the Beethoven, you can go to ShreveportSymphony.com or you can call 318-227-8863, which is TUNE on your phone dial to get your tickets for it. And both are going to be amazing concerts, but you know, in particular, getting the opportunity to hear the McDowell, it's going to be new. I was thinking about it. I can't think of anybody regionally, with the exception of the one time I conducted the second, and that was a long time ago, Michael, but that was in Monroe, so that's as close as we got. Forever ago. And I remember that. I remember the pianist, James Barbagallo. But I don't think anybody else has done it here. So for the region, this is going to be a real spectacular evening. So,
sure.
Anything you want to add to this? Because we are in a pledge drive. I do have to actually get back to raising money for the station.
But, well, I'll just say first of all that we so appreciate the opportunity to share events like this with your listening audience. That's one of the really, really important services that Red River Radio provides for our listening area. And I was not feeling so well earlier in the week. I wasn't able to join you as a guest here for the pledge drive, but I certainly would encourage all of our Shreveport Symphony fans to be supportive of this incredible community resource that Red River Radio is.
Well, thank you, Michael. Michael Betterman, my guest, and John Nakamatsu, who's going to be performing the McDowell and the additional music, Franck and Chopin, on Sunday. Thank you both for being here and being on the air. This is a treat. And if you're with an organization and you would like to be featured on a future spotlight, give us a call at 800-552-8502, which also happens to be the number you can call and make a donation. I'm throwing that in there to support this station. Call now, 800-552-8502. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.